Welcome to our podcast, Psychiatric Services, From Pages to Practice. In this podcast, we highlight new research or columns published this month in the journal Psychiatric Services. I'm Lisa Dixon, editor of Psychiatric Services, and I'm here with podcast editor and my co-host, Josh Berezin. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Lisa.
Good to be here again.
Good to be back in the heat.
Yes, in the saddle, or whatever the appropriate metaphor is. Today, we are not going to do an interview, which we've done for the last two editions. We like that very much, and we will come back to it, I promise you. We're going to be talking about three articles, and this is our usual format, but we're going to do something a little different, which is we have chosen three articles that touch on a theme, and the theme is integrating care, which is a big, big deal for us right now.
We've talked about many individual articles, but there's a few coming up in the upcoming issue of the journal, and we thought it'd be a good idea to really tackle one subject comprehensively.
Yeah, and you know, you can never get enough of integrated care. That's
hopefully
what I said.
Let's
okay,
hope.
So what are the articles that we're going to be discussing? The first one is going to be in the child arena, an article on a collaborative care model in pediatrics. The second article is going to be focusing on how well we share information between primary care providers and mental health providers. And thirdly, we're going to be looking at the impacts on utilization and expenditures of a whole health model implemented in a community mental health center.
Sounds good.
Let's get started.
First up, we have Catherine Grimes and colleagues on Enhanced Child Psychiatry Access and Engagement via Integrated Care, a collaborative practice model with pediatrics.
And I'm really glad to be focusing on an article in the child world as we're trying to get more of that kind of content in the journal.
Yeah, it's really important to be talking about the kids.
Yes.
Particularly because, as they mentioned, there's a high prevalence of mental illness among children and adolescents, something like 1 in 5.
Mm-hmm.
But a similar number in that 1 in 5 receive treatment.
Yeah, which is just really disturbing.
And so they're thinking through a couple of the reasons why that might be, including social determinants of health, co-occurring medical conditions, and workforce issues, actually all of which we've highlighted on different articles in the adult sphere on the podcast. And they're really looking to see if an integrated care model could help address these specific issues and increase access and engagement within an at-risk population.
Right.
And so their intervention here is to create what they call a collaborative practice model. And there's two main features here. One is psychiatric consultation for pediatricians, and then also peer supports for parents.
Yeah, and I love this innovative approach of including peer support for parents, that is, parents supporting parents.
Right, and it also, one thing that they mentioned as being really important is that they found that the peer specialists actually ended up informing the team as well. So they acted kind of as a translator between, they could tell the family what was going on, but they could also bring a family perspective back to the treatment team and help inform care.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the peer, family peer intervention part of it. But then also on the integrated care side of things, they had child mental health specialists join rounds, they shared notes with the pediatricians, and the pediatricians were more involved in treatment planning. And then really importantly, the evaluation actually occurred at the pediatric clinic site.
Right. So just to underline that, the psychiatric evaluation of the child occurred at the primary care site.
Right. And so what they did is they implemented this model at one clinic. This is kind of a network of 8 clinics. So at each of the clinics, kids could be referred for psychiatric care, but one of those clinics had this collaborative practice model. The other ones, they got usual care, which was an offsite psychiatric evaluation and no family peer supports.
Mm-hmm. And I want to add that, to my read, usual care here wasn't bad. I mean, they still had access to really good child psychiatry consultation. So, I mean, this is a stringent test to some extent of this collaborative practice model.
Because a lot of kids don't even get a referral and being seen timely for a psychiatric evaluation
right
at all, let alone the deluxe the deluxe model.
Exactly.
So their sample included 32 kids who were in the clinic who were referred for this collaborative practice model, mm-hmm. 29 of whom got an evaluation. And then in the seven other clinics, 196 kids were referred for psychiatric evaluation, and actually 157 were evaluated. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at these two outcomes, access and engagement. And access, they thought, they measured as receiving a psychiatric evaluation, and engaging as participating in one or more of recommended follow-ups, therapy, medications, or other follow-up that was recommended in the evaluation.
Mm-hmm. Right. So they're looking at care processes, not care outcomes yet. Does the CPM model improve access and engagement? That was their question.
And I know you'll want to say a word about the methodology here, because this isn't a randomized control trial.
All right. So that's the first thing that jumps out at you. And all research has its flaws, and all research has its limits in terms of external and internal validity. Here, this study compared the children receiving care at one clinic to the children receiving the control condition at the seven other clinics. And what they did was, so you have to say, well, are the kids the same?
No, they weren't the same.
They're not. So, oh, darn. You want them to be the same, or at least you want to be able to make an argument that they're the same, but they weren't the same. And so they had to do a number of statistical calisthenics.
Also known as propensity score matching.
I refer to think of them as calisthenics. It's a little more healthy.
Next paper.
Calisthenics, right. But essentially, they applied this statistical technology of using propensity score matching to try to equate or make similar the samples of kids at the two in the two arms.
So the kids aren't actually the same, but this propensity score matching makes them statistically more similar so that they can be compared.
Exactly.
On things like...
Josh, you are becoming a statistical
Watch out,
giant.
World. Here we come.
Okay, that's great. So what did they find?
So after applying this propensity matching, or their calisthenics, and controlling for age, gender, race, language, diagnosis, they found that kids in the intervention group had, this is pretty impressive, around four times the odds of accessing treatment and more than seven times the odds of engaging in treatment. So just to put it in another way, you would expect that 74% of kids that you referred for treatment would eventually engage in treatment in the CPM group versus 37% in the control group.
So that's about double. That's pretty, it's really, this is clinically meaningful. This is substantially different.
And I think many of the things that we mentioned while we were introducing the article are really the reasons why they felt like this was a successful intervention, particularly the family peer services and the co-location of the services.
So what do we make of this? I think we've already raised the issue that there was, yes, it's not the best design, but it was a good design. I found myself wondering if how easy it would be to replicate this intervention, this collaborative care type of intervention. It seemed pretty complex and required a lot of focus and interest and intensity. And I think that's something that would be tested in the future, hopefully. Mm-hmm.
And we'll actually come back to that in one of our other articles, where the intervention that's tested is very comprehensive. Mm-hmm. And we'll have to think through how that could be applied to other settings.
Right. So I think the next step for this research in testing this intervention would be a randomized trial or something that has a stronger design.
Sounds good. We'll look forward to that.
Yep.
Next up, we have Ben Kalayko and colleagues on continuity of information between mental health and primary care providers after a mental health consultation.
I love this paper because it's really obsessional. It's going into the record and just excavating and really digging into what the record tells us is happening.
I like this paper because literally right before I read it, I had been working with a primary care physician on a medication change around QTC prolongation. And it was so challenging to get in touch with the primary care provider. And there's a real incentive in the way our system is built to not have continuity of care between PCPs and mental health providers.
That's actually really important context for this article.
That really is the context for the article, is that it's a huge challenge.
Communication is difficult between primary care providers and mental health providers.
That's right. And so this article is trying to put some numbers behind that and to figure out how often that communication is actually happening. And their data set for this is coming from Medicare Advantage plans. So they looked at 6 Medicare Advantage plans and looked at their records from 2011 to 2012. And basically what they were doing is they were finding patients from those 6 plans who had had a new mental health visit in 2012. And they wanted to dig through the chart in that obsessional detail that you mentioned.
I love it, yeah.
To see what information had actually been communicated to the primary care physician.
Yeah, and what the primary care physician did to obtain the information.
That's right. So what their outcomes that they're looking for here are evidence of communication between the PCP and the mental health provider within 3 months of the mental health visit, PCP awareness of any mental health emergency or hospital visits, and then communication regarding psychotropic medication prescribing. And then they asked them to randomly select 50 of those to do this detailed chart abstraction that you're talking about. Really, they could have gotten data from 300 patients, right? 6 times 50, but they were able to abstract the data from 141 of those charts. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the other thing that's really important to note is that one of those 6 Medicare Advantage plans used a shared EMR, a mutual access electronic medical record.
Yeah, and I'm going to start using the phrase mutual access instead of shared in the future.
I'm going to stick with shared for right now. But the idea is that when a mental health provider writes a note, the PCP has access to it automatically because it's in the same electronic medical record. Or you can flag notes, or you can share consult notes. It makes this collaboration a lot easier.
And I know this just seems so simple, but again, we have to differentiate just the presence of an electronic health record from a shared or mutually accessible electronic health record. So that's part of what the study is able to do, is to look at the difference in those scenarios.
Right.
So what do they find? Overall, combining all the charts, they ask the question, how and what percentage of the time was there evidence that the primary care provider and the mental health provider actually had communication, that they tried to talk to each other, that they tried to communicate, that they tried to inform each other about the patient. And what did they find? Only 21% of the time overall was this observed. And they, you know, could they look at the notes? I tried to reach the doctor, I tried to talk to him, but only 21%. Okay, then when we look at the difference between the cases where there was a combined or shared electronic health record. Mutual access, right. Mutual access versus no mutual access changes a little bit.
It changes a lot.
Okay, all right, I'll grant you that. 46% of the time where there was a mutual access EHR, there was evidence of communication within 3 months. And in only 11% of the time where there was no shared access was there evidence of communication. 11% is 1 out of 10. Here, a patient gets a mental health consult for the first time, and only 1 out of 10 times does the primary care provider, do we have any evidence that the primary care provider is actually having contact or there's some dialogue between the two?
Yes. After I read this article, I put on my calendar to double back and make sure that I had spoken with the primary care provider. But you see a similar pattern when you look at whether or not the PCP really knows about medication changes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A shared EMR really makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense, right? Because it's really a much simpler process of reviewing a medication list that you already have access to.
Right.
So unsurprisingly, when they looked at shared EMRs, 100% of the time, there was continuity of medications between the mental health provider and the PCP, but only 57% of the time did that happen when there wasn't a shared EMR.
Right. And I guess the point you were making, Josh, is that it really is a lot easier with a mutual access EHR to have that at least cross information about medication.
Yeah, and the paper really slices and dices all of the things that they've looked at in the charts in a lot of different ways. But I think the take home is that something that we know already is that communication between PCPs and mental health providers is not that great. Mm-hmm. But that having this access to a shared electronic medical record does help.
Yes.
But it also maybe doesn't help as much as you might think it would, right? Mm-hmm. So when you look at evidence of communication going up to 46%, that's still less than half of the time.
Yeah.
So there's still a lot of room to grow even with a shared EMR isn't going to solve all of our problems here.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, if we reflect on this, one of the take homes for me is this is a shared responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think one entity or one party or the other should shoulder necessarily the blame or the credit. And I see it as a system problem. I mean, just the story you started with, you tried. And probably the primary care provider is maybe trying too. We don't even know.
Well, when I actually got them on the phone for the sort of initial discussion about it, they were so happy to have spoken with me about that. And they really wanted to know about what I was thinking and what I thought would be a good next step moving forward. But now on Monday morning, I'm probably going to be back on hold with the with their administrative assistants really waiting to be able to make that contact that is so crucial for this this client's care.
Yeah, and so this is about creating structures that facilitate communication.
Last up, we have Ellen Boucher and colleagues on implementing a whole health model in a community mental health center, impact on service utilization and expenditures.
They must have had to think a lot about this notion of whole health. Whole health, holistic health, I think that's what they're getting at, right?
Well, yeah, I think this article actually ties together. It's a good one to end on for our episode on care integration because they're tying together a lot of the themes that we've talked about before on how you can coordinate all these different aspects of care, specifically psychiatric care, physical health issues, and they're also including substance abuse issues as well in here.
Yep.
So this is a community mental health center in Kitsap County, Washington, and they got an innovation award from CMS. And the innovation award was to implement this program called Race to Health.
Mm-hmm.
Race to Health is really a comprehensive program that addresses a lot of these issues. It creates a multidisciplinary team. It adds medical assistance to better coordinate care. It funds staff training on wellness and recovery. Again, whole health, very comprehensive approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's bringing everybody up to speed on all of the health needs of the clients they serve.
Right. And so this article is seeing if the implementation of Race to Health changed hospitalization rates, utilization of emergency departments, office visits, and total Medicare expenditures.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did to look at this is they took data from 2009 to 2015, and they're comparing fee-for-service Medicare recipients at the clinic to matched controls from 16 similar clinics in the state.
So, okay, so there's really important methodological details in what you just said. So first of all, who is our sample? It's fee-for-service Medicare recipients.
Right, which is actually only 13% of the population that the CMHCs cover. But again, it's an innovation grant, and this is the population that they have this great data on, and so that's who they're looking at.
Right, and that's fine. It's just important to be aware. And then the second, I think, methodologic issue that you referred to is the fact that the individuals who got Race to Health are being compared to individuals being served at 16 similar clinics. So we're not talking a randomized design here.
Right. So we're 0 for 3 on randomized control trials today,
that's right.
which I know is giving you much chagrin.
Right. That's fine. I can deal with it. I can deal with it today.
Because they used optimal
they
matching.
They used optimal matching. And thank God they did not use suboptimal matching. They used, in all seriousness, they used a different methodology to try to make the two groups that they were comparing similar. So they didn't do propensity score matching. They did something that I don't fully understand, but that's okay, called optimal matching.
Right, but basically when you're matching, you're looking for a control population that basically meets the same demographic criteria as the people who are in the intervention group.
Okay, I can't let that go. It's not just demographic criteria, right? So there's a lot of other issues and characteristics that are important in understanding cost and service utilization. And so, you know, one of the really important and challenging tasks in doing these kinds of studies is really trying to figure out, given the data you have, how to do this matching procedure. So I don't think we need to go into more details about it. This is something that, like, if you want to get your PhD and you want to deal with this, I think it's really important, but we're just doing a podcast.
So no PhDs today. But to sum it up, yes. They're trying to find a population that's as similar as possible,
right,
as the ones who are in the intervention group.
Exactly.
Okay, one more methodological issue is that they're using a difference in difference design. So they're looking at the population in the clinic before the intervention goes into effect, and then they're looking after the intervention goes into effect, and they're seeing if there's a difference between those outcomes, rates of hospitalization use, emergency department use, office visits, and Medicare expenditures. Mm-hmm. And then they're comparing that to how those things changed at the other clinics.
Right. A difference in differences.
Difference in difference.
Right.
Okay. That's enough methodology for
right.
today.
All right. So what did they find?
So they ended up looking at 846 patients in the clinic that had the intervention, and then about 2,600 controls. What they found is that the monthly Medicare expenditure decreased $266 per month more in the intervention group than in the control group.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's a real difference. Yeah. And then another way that
it's a real difference in difference.
Okay.
So. Actually, we neglected to say that the most common diagnosis, you know, who were the patients? And they, just so it's a community mental health center, and the most common diagnosis of the patients was schizophrenia.
Right. So this is a serious mental illness
right.
Population
right.
they're dealing with. Just to put their results in another way, so for every two clients that they served, there was one less hospitalization. For every six clients that they served, there were five fewer ED visits. And for every one client they served, there were four fewer office visits. And very interesting in terms of the expenditures, those didn't occur in the first year of the intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Those actually happened after month 12.
Yeah. So they followed the expenditure, I think, for 5-6 month blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no difference in the expenditures in the first 2 6-month blocks. The differences were really seen in the out period of time, which to me makes so much sense, because as they discuss in the paper, there's a learning curve involved here, that there's a time needed for the staff and actually I think also for the patients to learn this and to use it well.
Well, the other thing that I thought was interesting is that the different staff members actually expanded their roles as the intervention continued, right? So they're creating this multidisciplinary team to address the whole health of the client. And they had medical assistants who were addressing a lot of the communication issues that we talked about in the last article. But they actually ended up running wellness groups,
mm-hmm.
right? Psych nurses who are helping with some of the physical health needs of the clients are actually starting to educate the rest of the team on general health issues, just like we saw in the previous paper that the family peer services mm-hmm. served a role of educating the actual team. So it's not that that's that they learned, but that the intervention became in some senses more robust as time went on.
And I think that it's there's an organic process involved here, that in some sense what I got from reading this paper was that really the whole culture and mission in some sense of the staff and the clients together really evolved into really a whole health focus.
And we should also say that they really took this on in full force, that this was a major overhaul of the entire culture of their clinic, not just in terms of staffing, but it sounds like from the paper in terms of philosophy. And so this was a big, they really had to turn a big ship around.
Yeah, yeah. And so again, we have to remember that there are methodological limitations to this study. Again, only 13% of the clients that they serve at the program, that it wasn't a randomized trial. So it's really, there are threats to internal validity in terms of cause and effect attribution, but it's promising. And it tells us that, I think just the notion that that this program, this, you know, large clinic could change the way it does business is very exciting. That's all for today on Integrated Care. Next month, we'll see. Don't know yet. Figure it out. We invite you to visit our website, ps.psychiatryonline.org, to read the articles we discussed in this episode, as well as other great research. We also welcome your feedback. Please email us at psjournal@psych.org. You can also rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to it. I'm Lisa Dixon.
I'm Josh Berzin.
Thank you for listening. We'll talk with you next time.